Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Carolina, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer, Coping with Loss of Strength. Now, this is a very important program, and it is a program that we're doing in collaboration with many other cancer organizations, and it is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on our program today. We have on the program today over 597 participants. So you come from all over the United States, from all different states and regions of this country. And we also have international participants from Canada, Greece, and the United Kingdom. So this is truly an international call as well. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers, about the topics they'll be covering, and about all the different collaborating organizations. And there also is information in your packets about really an evaluation form in your packets. And we'd ask you all to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us what topics we should be offering going forward? We are entering soon into 2012. We're planning many programs for that year, and we take very seriously your recommendations. Indeed, the topic for today's program is one that really was driven by many of your comments that you've written about the programs that you'd like us to approach this topic. So very much we depend on your feedback, and so tell us what you think, and we will try very hard to implement those programs. Now, this program today was made possible through an educational grant from GTX, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of our workshop today. They're also supporting a fact sheet that you'll all be getting within about a month of the program. So I just want to let you know that you'll shortly also be getting a fact sheet as well for some additional information. Now, we have just wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Thomas Lynch. Dr. Lynch is the Jonathan and Richard Sackler Professor of Medicine. He's Director, Yale Cancer Center, Physician-in-Chief, Smilo Cancer Hospital, Yale, New Haven. And Dr. Lynch is going to address an overview of non-small cell lung cancer. He's going to present a current standard of care and new treatment options and the important role of clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Lynch.
Well, Carolyn, thank you very much for that lovely introduction, and thank you to all of the listeners and participants for being here today to talk about lung cancer. What I'd like to do is to really give you a couple of things that I think are really important that I say to every family member and patient who's been newly diagnosed with lung cancer. The first is this small cell lung cancer or is this non-small cell lung cancer? It's an important distinction, and it's one that will help guide therapy. Now, today we're talking about non-small cell lung cancer, but making that initial distinction is done by the pathologist and is actually quite important. Now, the second important thing is once you know it's non-small cell lung cancer, the question really then revolves around what type of non-small cell lung cancer and then what stage of disease it is, because how we treat lung cancer very much is dependent upon the stage. As many of you may know, we now have new procedures for screening for lung cancer, which may well make a difference in how patients do, and we'll be seeing many more people with earlier stage lung cancer as time evolves. So the first question is, what is stage? Stage refers to how advanced a cancer may be at the time of presentation. So a stage 1 cancer is a localized tumor that can be operated on or treated with focal radiotherapy. It's usually just a nodule which is present in the lung. Stage 2 lung cancer is usually a lung nodule plus some involvement of some regional lymph nodes, but all those lymph nodes are still within the lung itself. Stage 3 lung cancer refers to lung cancer that's gone outside the lung and has gone to lymph nodes in the central part of the chest. And that usually means that surgery isn't the only thing that can be done for those patients. They're certainly going to need radiation and certainly need chemotherapy, and surgery may not help people once those lymph nodes in the central part of the chest are involved. Stage 4 lung cancer involves lung cancer that's gone throughout the entire body and spread possibly to the brain or the liver or the adrenal gland or the skin. And so those are the things that we look at in thinking about the stage. And the stage helps a patient and a family understand, who do I need to be involved? Do I need to see a surgeon? Do I need to see a medical oncologist? We recommend whenever possible that you see a multidisciplinary team, which is a surgeon, a medical oncologist, a radiation oncologist, and often a pulmonary expert to help guide your initial treatment decisions. In some large cancer centers, this can be done at a single visit, but at many excellent hospitals around the country, it can be done virtually by seeing these individual providers separately. The second question then is, once you know the stage, is to understand what type of lung cancer is it. And this is something which, when I first did these teleconferences 5 to 10 years ago, was a much quicker discussion, because you really only had four histology types. You had adenocarcinoma, large cell carcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, and then a grab bag that we called not otherwise specified. Now we think we have adenocarcinoma, large cell, squamous. We rarely call something not otherwise specified. But what's emerged since then is an understanding of, within adenocarcinoma, that there are several important molecular subtypes of lung cancer that help to drive therapy. Now, it's also important to know whether you're dealing with an adeno, a squamous, or a large cell, because the type of treatment the doctor will recommend will be influenced by that. If you know you have adenocarcinoma, okay, then one of the questions to ask is this a molecularly defined type of it, meaning do we know what gene could be driving that cancer? And those genes are EGFR and ALK, A-L-K, and RAS, R-A-S, and a brand new one called ROS, R-O-S. And so looking at those genes, your doctor can test for those four genes and find out whether or not those genes are involved in lung cancer. And one can then go ahead and offer treatment which is specifically geared to the specific gene which is seen. Now, only about 10 to 15% of patients will turn out to have a genetic change that helps guide therapy. But it's such an important distinction for those patients to know that, because it means you wouldn't start with chemotherapy. It means you would probably start with an oral pill, which really can be more effective than chemotherapy in that setting. So, as I mentioned, first important thing to find out about stage, second, about the molecular subtype and the histology, whether it's adenocarcinoma, squamous cell cancer, or large cell cancer. And then it comes to the question of treatment. So how do we treat a non-small cell lung cancer? Well, if it's localized, which is what we hope it is, and we're hoping that screening will lead to more cancers being detected early. If it's localized cancer, meaning still in the lung, we would hope that surgery or focused radiation could be used. Now, why would you use surgery versus focused radiation? Well, surgery is an excellent way of removing the cancer, but it also ends up removing a fair amount of normal lung as well. And some patients don't have the lung reserve to have all of that normal lung removed at the same time. So we actually find that for those patients, sometimes focused radiation can actually prove to be a safer way of treating lung cancer, and that's for local disease. For locally advanced disease, meaning when it's not just stage 1 or stage 2, but it's gone to the lymph nodes in the central part of the chest, in that setting, chemotherapy, radiation, and maybe surgery can be used, and those are the ones that really require a lot of discussion before beginning a specific treatment. Now, what about patients where the cancer has spread through the whole body? And that is about half the patients who we see at the time of presentation, and it's also about half the patients who undergo surgery or focused radiation for the treatment of earlier stage disease eventually have a recurrence and need to be treated with what we call systemic therapy, or therapy that goes through the whole body. And that's where we use chemotherapy and what we call targeted therapy to treat specific cancers. So chemotherapy is able to make patients live longer. It's able to make patients have less symptoms, but it also has been shown to be associated with some fatigue. And I know we're going to be talking today about energy levels and how treatment affects patients' energy levels, and I think that's an important thing to consider when you look at the impact of chemotherapy. But your doctor will choose your chemotherapy based on understanding as much as they can of the pathology of your tumor and the type of cancer that you're facing. As I mentioned earlier, the genetic testing is important because if you have one of those three or four important genetic changes, that will help guide your oncologist to be able to select either chemotherapy or an oral therapy for your cancer. As many of you may know, the drug crizotinib was approved this summer for the treatment of patients who have ALK mediated non-small cell lung cancer. So that's ALK non-small cell lung cancer, something that we look for. And then finally, I think it's important that you have a team that supports you through this process. And some groups have shown that involving palliative care specialists or symptom management specialists and nurse practitioners can really help make a big difference in how patients do. And I think as we focus and think about the impact of fatigue, it's important to recognize that one of the biggest reasons for fatigue happens to be something like depression or anxiety, and recognizing those important side effects of therapy also are important. I want to thank you very much, and I look forward to discussion a little bit later on.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Lynch, for just a very outstanding presentation and very informative, just remarkably informative, lots of information for everybody on the call. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Richard Gralla. Dr. Gralla is the Medical Director, Quality of Life Research Associates, and Dr. Gralla is going to present on coping with cancer-related weight changes, loss of strength and muscle loss, and enhancing strength and lean body mass. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Gralla.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and I, too, would like to extend my welcome to all participating on this call and appreciate the opportunity to discuss some additional aspects of lung cancer. Among the many issues accompanying cancer can be the constellation of problems seen as weight loss, loss of muscle, decreased appetite, loss of energy with fatigue, and this constellation has been one of the most frustrating that patients and families have to deal with. It's an all-too-frequent example of the fact that cancer can have direct effects based on its very location in the body, and it can have indirect whole-body complications. Other examples of whole-body physical problems, sometimes called paraneoplastic issues, can be bone loss, anemia, fever, skin rash, and many others. Some paraneoplastic problems can be uncommon. However, this weight, muscle, energy loss problem occurs very frequently. Since we're focusing on lung cancer, and Dr. Lynch has just introduced this topic, my remarks, too, will examine this problem for patients with lung cancer, this problem of fatigue and weight loss. In fact, fatigue is the most common presenting complaint of patients with lung cancer that has spread beyond the lungs, such as stage 3 or 4 extent, as described by Dr. Lynch. In fact, over 80% of patients report fatigue at the time of diagnosis. Weight loss is also common in patients with this presentation of lung cancer, which illustrates that lung cancer is often a disease that has effects on the whole body well beyond the lungs. In fact, weight loss can be so important that when we study new treatments for lung cancer, the amount of weight loss is often factored in as a key issue. It's not completely clear why and how weight, muscle, energy, and appetite loss occurs. Interesting evidence shows that as a reaction to some serious illnesses, such as infection or cancer, the body produces substances, often called cytokines, that lead to these problems. As we know, this primitive reaction is not very effective in fighting the cancer. Two approaches to this would be to try to turn off the production of the cytokines, or to try to affect directly strength and appetite. And to make matters more difficult, the problems of weight, muscle, energy, and appetite loss not only relate to the cancer itself, but also, as has been mentioned, can be linked with anti-cancer treatments, especially including radiotherapy and chemotherapy in patients with advanced stages of the disease. Now, what is clear is that there's a great need to improve the control over this problem. We recently asked about 250 patients with lung cancer and their support persons about issues of importance to them. Nearly 90% of these individuals identified nutrition, appetite, and weight loss as being among the top concerns. 91% reported that dealing with fatigue was a highly important problem. All these issues interfere with patients pursuing their normal activities, and 96% of another 600 patients with lung cancer told us that normal functioning is crucial for them. So these frustrating problems that you may be dealing with or are certainly those that others have expressed how common this problem is also. So the need for improvement is abundantly clear. What treatments are currently available? Well, the best and most effective treatment is to destroy the cancer itself, thus stopping the related stimulus for muscle and weight loss. But of course, this is not always possible. And even if the cancer is controlled but still present, the energy, muscle, and weight loss can continue. Paying attention to good, balanced nutrition and proper hydration is always important. While this can be helpful, it's not usually sufficient to reverse these persistent problems. We'll hear more about nutritional steps and strategies in just a few minutes as part of this program, and about some of the benefits of exercise as well. An available medical approach has been to use a hormone that is a progesteronic agent, a progesterone, called megase or medroxyprogesterone. This can have some effect on appetite and weight, but it does not build back lost muscle. Side effects of this medicine include fluid retention, swelling, and increased likelihood to form clots or thrombosis. So it's got its issues. A large, well-conducted study compared megase to the major active ingredient of marijuana, THC. The megase did better than THC, but neither did as well as one would hope. And they also compared a combination of megase plus THC, but this wasn't better than the megase itself. So this is an area where evidence-based research is mandatory. Fortunately, there are major research initiatives underway right now. Let me describe a few of these research paths. One approach is to try to improve the utilization of energy right at the cell level, the way our cells use energy, in the tissues of importance, such as muscle tissue. It's an interesting concept, but so far it needs further development. A newer interesting line of investigation involves a hormone that we all have called ghrelin. Ghrelin stimulates hunger and also stimulates the release of growth hormone, which can then help to build muscle strength. Trials are now being conducted using drugs that work in this pathway. And another new and promising approach is to stimulate new muscle growth and the body's use of energy by what are called SARMs, or selective androgen receptor modulators. Perhaps a better way of defining a SARM would be to call it a designer androgen. Both men and women normally make testosterone, obviously in different amounts, and this hormone, an androgen, helps maintain good muscle tone. By making a selective designed androgen like medicine, an androgen-like medicine or SARM, it's possible to preserve the muscle-building properties while eliminating the masculinizing, the male-type features. So if this approach is successful, it can produce a medicine that helps with muscle and weight loss as well as build energy and lead to better ability to maintain normal functioning activities while at the same time minimizing side effects. It's great to know that there's a lot of research being done right now in this area, and that these and other important clinical trials for the U.S. are outlined on the website clinicaltrials.gov. These and other approaches are based on basic knowledge of energy and muscle metabolism and hold new promise for improving these frequent and difficult problems for many with lung cancer and other malignancies. Hopefully, in the near future, we'll be able to report to you on successful evidence from these initiatives. I'll now turn the program back to Carolyn Messner.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Grala. It's a wonderful presentation. Also, a wonderful look into the future and in terms of also everyone understanding about the research that's being conducted on this topic. It's very important. So that really very helpful. Thank you so much. Our next speaker, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Donna Wilson. And Donna is pulmonary clinical nurse specialist. She's a fitness coordinator in Integrative Medicine Center at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Donna is going to address the role of exercise, rehabilitative medicine, and strength exercises. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Donna.
Hello there. Welcome to everyone. My position here is that many years we've always told all of you when you get diagnosed with cancer to rest and to take it easy. Well, I'm coming from the different perspective to tell you, you have to keep moving. I think that for the many years, 40 years that I've been doing this, I've noticed that the most important thing I can do is to keep people active. And we're not saying that you have to go to a gym and go on a treadmill and do things. There's lots of things that you can do. My goal is that you want to increase your energy level, or so far by increasing your energy level, we can decrease the fatigue. And there's many, many research articles out there to show, and I've done it myself, to show that if people exercise, that they, and I measure their energy level compared to a group that did not exercise, it's been very obvious that the level of energy is much, much better in the group that exercised. What are those exercises? Well, you think about this. Now, this is something to deal with the lung, and this is breathing. The first thing I'm going to go back to is, why do you breathe, and how do you breathe? You breathe because of the muscles of your chest wall. It's that simple. So if your muscles, if you become very debilitated and you have this muscle loss, you get very weak. By doing exercises of your chest wall, and it doesn't have to be many, and I can explain a few, but if you exercise just doing some arm exercises, some breathing exercises, you then move those skeletal muscles and improve them. Skeletal muscles respond to when you exercise. So you think about using muscles to use for the large muscle groups. Every muscle contraction that you do in your body when you're walking or when you're sitting and standing, anything you do takes oxygen. So now you say you have to learn how to coordinate your pattern of breathing with your activity level. You can't just think that, oh, I can just kind of go 10 steps and it's no big deal because you breathe normally. Now you say, how can I maximize my breath to do this activity? The most important aspect of breathing is to breathe out. As I worked with many, many clients over the years, the first I asked them to take a deep breath in and breathe out. When they always think they have to breathe in longer and not breathe out. Breathing out is by far the most important aspect. So you want to lengthen that time you breathe out. So you want to strengthen those muscles. And even all the muscles of the shoulders, lots of us that have lung disease, that you kind of get bent over, your shoulders get slightly rounded, so that you now are putting your chest wall in an almost a restricted component. I have a little mantra, and my whole mantra is considered, it's lift chest, shoulders down, so I can get your lifting your posture. Posture has a lot to do with breathing. If you're bent over, you can't breathe quite as well. That's why you want to really get yourself sitting up nice and tall. Breathing in through the nose, you will always use your diaphragm. Holding the breath in for a couple of seconds and then blowing it out long is very important. When I did a study with surgical patients and had exercised them all for 3 weeks prior to surgery, they all did dramatically better postoperatively because they were in such good physical shape. And that goes back as when I started that, is I would do stair climbing exercises with them. And anyone that has any kind of lung disorder, when you look at stairs, you immediately go, oh, no. But, you know, if you know how to climb stairs correctly, it's not difficult. When you think about it, every time you put your foot on a step, your whole body is on one leg. That leg is holding your body up with gravity. You breathe out as you go up the step. So if you think about breathing out with each step that you go up, you then can do it much better without getting to the top of the stairs and feeling exhausted. The reason, and I do believe that also the exercise decreases one's depression and anxiety. And I think that by monitoring your level of energy, when you're getting treatment, surgery is a different story, because usually the couple of weeks after surgery you take it easy, but then you have to start moving because you want to really keep the flexibility of the upper body. When you're getting chemo or radiation, I often tell people to keep a diary of how you feel. Okay, if chemo is on Monday, do you feel bad on Tuesday and Wednesday? And you might feel like, I just couldn't move, I can't do anything. Then you should say this, okay, this has been 3 days. I need to get up. And even if you just walk around your home and walk around for 3 or 4 minutes, consistently and continuously. The most important thing is it's just not to sit. Being sedentary and getting your muscles weaker is only going to increase your level of fatigue and increase your level of just feeling exhausted all the time. So you really want to put yourself on a walking program. Remember, the walking program doesn't mean that you have to walk fast. Endurance is probably more important right now. There's things I teach people to do, a chair squat, but lifting up and down, but coordinating your breathing, going up and down. So when I look at you, I would say when you do breathing exercises and you do your upper body exercises, do them in a chair so that you can sit upright, not to worry about your legs getting tired standing. You're sitting in a chair, you lift your chest up, you do some breathing exercises, do some arm exercises. Breathe out and bring your arms over your head and down. Bring your arms forward and back. Keeping the flexibility is extremely important. As we get more flexible, then you start increasing some strength. There's no reason if you just make a fisted hand and move your arms up and down. When you make a fist in your hand, you increase the fiber activation of all the muscles of your arms, and you can actually improve strength that way. Then if you feel that that's not enough, you can take a very light weight, or you can even take a bottle of water using that to try to do the strength. But try to think about how you have to improve and keep track of your energy level, keep track of your exercise performance, so that you can say, well, you know, the next 5 days, I have a week off from chemo, I have a week off of something, or I just know I want to feel better, the weather's nice, or I can go to the mall and walk around. Whatever you can do to modify your exercise performance and your physical performance is only going to improve how you feel. I am going to stop here, and I welcome you all to ask me any questions. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Donna. That was really wonderful. And again, those very specific tips that you gave everyone to really use are so very helpful, and just and often people don't think about some of the things that you mentioned as really being able to help to build strength. So thank you. Excellent. Our next presenter is Linda Pataki. And I have to say, this is truly a multidisciplinary team that you have on this call. We have really all the different disciplines represented. Linda Pataki is a dietitian. She's supervisor of clinical nutrition, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Linda is going to present on nutritional concerns, eating hints, dietary changes, and recommendations. And I now turn the program over to Linda.
Thank you, Carolyn, and I want to thank everyone who's listening in today as well. I really want to build on what Dr. Grala was talking about, because when we talk about nutrition, our goal isn't just about weight. Weight is a measure of nutritional status, but we really want to focus on protecting lean body mass or muscle mass. What happens is I talk to patients and they end up eating a lot of junk food because it has a lot of calories in it. And while that's true, it's also void of vitamins and minerals and good qualities of protein. And as Donna was talking about, exercise and maintaining muscle mass is much more important. It's a lot easier to gain back fat stores than it is to gain back muscle mass. You actually have to do the physical work in order to get your muscle mass back. So from a nutrition standpoint, our goal is to protect it as best we can. And that's through eating a healthy diet and focusing in on the foods that give us the biggest bang for our buck. So in terms of nutritional goals, I usually start patients out at about 1 gram protein per kilogram. And if you wanted to figure that out for yourself, you take your weight and you divide it by 2.2, and that'll give you your goal for protein. That's how much you weigh in kilograms. And so 1 gram per kilogram, that would be your goal for protein. Best sources of protein are from animal products: beef, pork, poultry, fish. If you're very short of breath and you're not able to chew food very well, then you probably want to focus on modifying the texture of those foods. Other things that are good sources of protein are dairy products. So cheese and crackers is a great snack. Or if you like fruit, cottage cheese and fruit. Some of the Greek yogurts, and I say specifically the Greek yogurts because they have somewhere in the neighborhood of 16 to 19 grams of protein per kilogram. Grams protein per 6 ounce serving, whereas the typical yogurts have someplace in the neighborhood of 6 to 9. So that's a great way of getting extra protein in the diet. And soy products as well, whether it's soy nuts or soy tofu, are also great alternatives to meat. Regarding commercial supplements, they're great for when you're moving out and about, but people can get tired of them, so making milkshakes and smoothies at home also helps. And the final thing that I want to talk about is getting your fluids in. When people talk about fluids, they usually think about water, and water is your best source of fluids, but soups and popsicles, sports drinks, Pedialyte are also alternatives, so if taste or flavor is an issue, then that would be something that you might want to use as an alternative to getting your fluids in. Again, calculating fluid needs, I would do the same thing for fluids as a starting point as I did with the protein. About 1 ounce per kilogram of body weight is a good starting point, and then you can adjust that based on your other medical conditions and your environmental conditions. So the last thing I also want to mention is small portions, not trying to eat a lot at one time, but rather eating frequently. So thank you, Carolyn, and I look forward to everyone's questions.
Well, thank you very much, Linda, also for presenting all of the very specific information for people, practical facts, information that they can use on a day-to-day basis in terms of just hints of increasing their dietary intake. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you, and it's just an excellent presentation. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Jimmy Holland. And Dr. Holland is the Wayne E. Chapman Chair in Psychiatric Oncology, Attending Psychiatrist, Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Dr. Holland actually is well known in our field of oncology, and she is truly the founder of psycho-oncology in our field. And Dr. Holland is going to address the emotional and social impact of non-small cell lung cancer and quality of life concerns and coping tips. It's my pleasure and honor to turn the program over to Dr. Holland.
Thank you very much, and it's a great pleasure to be talking to so many people who are on this teleconference and to be part of this faculty. It's my real pleasure to be part of it. I think we just start by thinking for a moment what you felt like when you heard the news that you had the words lung cancer attached to you. I think sometimes the first response is it can't be true, they're making a mistake, but then it begins to sink in that maybe it is true and you have to deal with it. And then the first issues are kind of, well, who do I tell? Certainly the family's going to know about it, but do I tell my friends? Do I tell all of my relatives? Do I tell people at work? These kinds of social, psychological issues begin to immediately come to bear on the person who is facing not only painful, difficult news, dealing with a new illness out of the blue oftentimes, but now who and what do I do about it? And one of the things that I've been doing for 15 years, a group at Memorial Sloan Kettering for patients with lung cancer, and they often talk about and laugh about what terrible things people say to them. And a big complaint is often the question, oh, did you smoke? As if, you know, well, we're going to blame you. It's your own fault. You got this, so just you brought it on yourself idea. And, you know, we never knew so much about smoking, and when you have an illness, we don't do that with people with heart attacks. We don't blame them for their having a heart attack, even though they may have eaten a lot of red meat. So it's interesting to, I think, help to guide people a little bit. So, you know, I don't need to hear things like that. I need your support. I'm here to talk to you about it because we're friends, and I want to be sure that we stay that way. The other thing people will often say is, oh, you've got cancer. You've got to be positive to beat cancer. Well, there's no data that says you have to be positive. And again, we don't tell people who have heart attacks you have to be positive to beat it. We have this kind of stigma attached to cancer that I think adds a whole level of burden to having the illness, and it's unfair. It's unfair, and it's not right, and so we have to keep working against the stigma, against lung cancer in particular, but cancer in general. There is still a kind of an aura about cancer. Remember, for so long we never used the word. We talked about the big C. We kept it a secret. Some of that still hangs on. I think then, given the interaction with other people, the interior worry and concern anyone has with any cancer diagnosis, but particularly with lung cancer, is that sense of uncertainty. What's going to happen next? What's the next scan going to show? Is it going to be negative? Is it going to be positive? What'll I do if it's one or the other? And I've had people in the group who say, you know, I live from one scan to the next, and I get a little crazy the week before the scan because I'm so worried, and when it comes back negative and normal, then I go on and live my life to the next scan. So we have to find a way to deal with that uncertainty. There's no one who can say 100% what the outcome is going to be, and yet so we're left with this kind of limbo of uncertainty, and I did a little book for people which has a subtitle of Living with Hope but Coping with Uncertainty. And I often tell people we can only live today, we can't live yesterday, we can't live tomorrow. We only have today to live, and so it behooves us to make the best and to live as fully each day as we can and to find some way to kind of put that uncertainty in a little box in the back of our brain and just keep it there and know that it's going to be there. We're not going to destroy it, eliminate it fully, but to find a way to kind of deal with it in a way that lets you go forward and fully live each day as you deal with a great deal on your plate, as you go from tests and scans to treatments to decisions. It is a great deal on your plate, and I admire the courage and the really persistence and resilience of people going through illness, and it's my pleasure to be part of the team that provides support, and I think that is important, and if you're feeling so down you can't get the treatment, it's important to remember that there's hope out there. In most places there's teams that help the oncologist, and it's no sign of weakness or being a wimp if you say, boy, I'm so nervous, I just can't make it, I need a little help. So I'd like you to be confident that you're doing the right thing, and I can assure you you're doing the right thing when you do ask for help. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Holland, for really addressing many of these issues that are on everyone's mind during this call, that are participating in this call today, and for really giving words to them and also giving suggestions in terms of how to cope. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Wynn Berkel. And Wynn is an oncology social worker. He's director of social service in Long Island, and he's a lung cancer program coordinator for cancer care. And Wynn is going to address for you all of the services that you can access, the free services that you can access from cancer care. And also we'll talk about our lung cancer support program. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Wynn.
Thank you, Carolyn. You know, I'm sure most of us remember the time that we moved into our first new home or maybe our last new home, and I'm sure we wondered how we were ever going to find our way in this new community or neighborhood. Many of us were fortunate enough to get a visit from the welcome wagon or maybe a very helpful neighbor who helped us find the nearest supermarket, service station, house of worship, school, and all the other services so essential to support our daily life. The more things we were able to connect to in our new neighborhood, the more we felt that we had things under control. Being diagnosed with lung cancer is in some ways very much like moving into a new neighborhood. Our cancer pushes us into a strange and sometimes scary new environment, and we really don't know where anything is and what we can do to get some control over a very difficult change in our lives. Cancer Care, in the role of that good neighbor, provides its popular website, lungcancer.org, to better serve people like you. Rather than burden folks with heavy medical jargon, lungcancer.org has been designed as the first stop for people who find themselves in this new and strange neighborhood of lung cancer. Using simple to understand language in a user-friendly web page format, lungcancer.org helps patients and those who care for them learn about basic facts on lung cancer, how it can be prevented, the different types of lung cancer, how lung cancer is detected and screened, the stages of lung cancer, treatments for lung cancer, and the terms used in talking about lung cancer. And there's a special section on clinical trials, which not only helps one learn what they're all about, but also provides a special search tool which can assist in finding the lung cancer clinical trial that matches each patient's individual situation. And if a patient wishes to become involved in a clinical trial, there is a tool that allows them to connect with a specially trained clinical trials manager to help them with the whole process. In addition, lungcancer.org serves as an easy entrance to connect with the many services which Cancer Care has available, free of charge, for lung cancer patients and those who care for them. Services such as education. Cancer Care's many Connect education workshops provide both disease-specific information and workshops on coping with the physical and emotional impacts of lung cancer, such as we're doing today in this workshop. Cancer Care's well-known Cancer Care Connect booklets are available free of charge and are packed with up-to-date information on treatments and the latest coping strategies to help lung cancer patients and those who care for them. To date, we have distributed over 2.5 million of these very popular publications free of charge. Cancer Care's website at www.cancercare.org provides a wealth of information on cancer topics and serves as an easy-to-use entry point to Cancer Care's many services, including subscribing to its popular free monthly e-newsletter. Some of the services that can be connected to Cancer Care's professional trained staff of experienced oncology social workers are there to assist folks like you in dealing with the many issues which arise from the diagnosis of lung cancer, including emotional issues in which the worker can assess clients and provide appropriate helpful interventions. Practical issues such as financial assistance through Cancer Care's limited financial assistance program and referrals to the Cancer Care Copay Foundation and other financial assistance resources. Issues of resource referral to the many organizations and agencies established to help lung cancer patients. Issues such as navigating the system and being able to understand how to best manage the many new relationships involved in health care and communications. Social issues such as dealing with cancer care, lung cancer's impact among family members, friends, the community, and the workplace. Now, Cancer Care social workers provide this assistance in a variety of user-friendly settings such as individual counseling and face-to-face in the New York Tri-State metropolitan area, online and telephone counseling. Support groups face-to-face, again in the New York Tri-State metropolitan area, and nationally online and via telephone. You know, I'm sure none of us ever expected to find ourselves moved to the neighborhood of lung cancer. But now that you're here, be assured that Cancer Care, like that good neighbor, is there with you. Connect with us at www.cancercare.org or calling us at 1-800-813-HOPE. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Wynn, and it's a wonderful concept that Cancer Care is your good neighbor to call us as you need help. And also thank you for going over the lungcancer.org site and all the different services that Cancer Care offers. And now we have time for questions. I'm going to ask Carolina to bring all of our speakers on board now. And we now have lots of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Janitha to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we'll take as many as we can. Janitha?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from queue, you may do so by pressing the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions simply by clicking ask a question.
And we have a question from actually one of the participants on the web who indicates that that they're still working after a fourth treatment for non-small cell lung cancer, but they are really having issues with fatigue and weakness and wants to continue working, but is looking for suggestions on how to maintain strength and overcome the fatigue. So this question actually involves a number of our speakers. I'm going to start with Dr. Lynch first, and then Donna Wilson, if you could add into this as well. Let's try with that first anyway. Dr. Lynch?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that you don't want fatigue to
to slow patients down. I think recognizing that it is a fact or something that happens to patients during treatment is important. Oftentimes, with time, patients will begin to do many of the things you heard about from the other speakers, such as exercising, such as approaching diet in a way that maximizes useful calories. And I think those kinds of actions allow people to maximize their energy levels, that they're able to tolerate treatments and get through their therapy as best they can.
And Donna, do you want to add to that?
Yes. I think the fatigue is something that it's not a type of fatigue that we can say, okay, just go and rest for a short time and it'll go away. That's why I think if you, when you're at work, even if you just get up from what you're doing and do some 10 knee lifts and you start to incorporate little points of exercise to maintain the strength that you have in those muscles. So if you can maintain the strength in the muscles, then you may not, the fatigue may be less. So I think that even you're working, which is wonderful, I think it's terrific, and I think that's a great thing to do because it takes a lot of energy, but make sure that maybe you get up a few minutes early in the morning and do some chair squats or just kind of do some leg lifts or do, you know, you can put your arms against the wall and do some arm, you know, push-ups just to do, just to get the muscles moving, or do some deep breathing and arm circles to get them generated some muscle strength and the blood flowing, but keep things moving, and because when you start get that muscle movement, you produce a lot of different things in the muscle itself, and that does help take away the fatigue.
Can I respond, Jimmy Holland? May I respond too? Thank you. I think it's important to keep in mind that depression can, being depressed, can often contribute to this feeling of fatigue. When you feel down and down in the dumps, it's pretty hard to feel energetic at the same time. So while certainly fatigue is a major problem with as a result of the treatment, I think one should remember that depression could add to that, and that if you are very depressed, not sleeping well, feeling sort of, below par in a psychological way, it might be important to have somebody assess that.
That's I'd like to also point. Jump in and contribute that hydration or fluid status can also contribute to fatigue, and that a lot of people find it very challenging to meet their fluid goals during the day. And I would suggest setting small goals. By 9 a.m. I will have consumed 8 ounces of some liquid, and by noon I'll have consumed 24 ounces, and that makes it a little bit easier.
Dr. Gralla?
Yeah, I agree with, I think that was Linda who made the last comment that it's tough sometimes at work to make sure that you're getting adequate fluids, and that I think is key. And the other thing is to identify, do you have to work 8 hours a day? And if you can work 3 days a week or 4 days a week or 6 hours a day or something like this, preserving your energy for the activities that are most important, that can be a good strategy and allow you to have some time for yourself as well. But do make sure that you keep up with fluids, et cetera. And it is great to be continuing to work. That's what it's all about, continuing your normal activities as much as possible.
And actually, Dr. Gall, you raise a very good point in terms of the work is so important. And indeed, there are protections for people who have cancer and are in the workplace. There's the Americans with Disabilities Act, and there's also Intermittent Family Medical Leave Act. And actually, Daniel, I'd be happy to talk with you after the program about that. But there are protections so that if you do need to take some time, but to continue working, but just modify your day, often workplaces will be able to accommodate that. It's a workplace accommodation.
And they're often very pleased to do so.
Absolutely. And Wynn, did you want to add anything?
No, I just think, sort of chiming in with everyone else, that it's certainly great to be working, but I think the one thing you need to keep in mind is that you're also a lung cancer patient in treatment, and you need to set realistic expectations as to what your physical strength is now, rather than trying to match yourself up against what you could do at work before all this started. So when you make your expectations fit your current environment, it can really make you feel very successful in what you're doing.
That's an excellent question. Thank you. Our next question, Carolina?
We have a question from the line of Jan C. Go ahead.
I'd like to address the DNA aspect of the type of cancer because it says it's only 10 to 15% effective. And I've been offered a bronchoscopy to do a check what kind of cancer I have. How worthwhile is this?
Okay, that's an interesting question. Dr. Lynch, are you able to address that question?
Well, I would say that when I said about 10 to 15% of patients, we will find a gene that can influence our treatment, okay? But if you don't look in all patients, you'll never find those patients who might benefit. So if your doctor has recommended that you have a biopsy to be able to do that, I would certainly encourage you to work with your doctor to do that, because that could help guide the treatment. And for those 15% of the patients where we find an answer in the DNA test, it could make a big difference, because the treatment can be much more effective and have better side effects for many patients, not for all, but for many patients. I think the frustrating thing is that it's only 15% who seem to be benefited by this, and 85% of patients go through the effort and don't get the benefit from it. Our hope is, with more research and a better commitment to doing trials, we may find additional groups of patients who may benefit.
And would you, Dr. Lynch, comment a bit about just the whole concept of research and clinical trials for the audience in terms of understanding how we progress in the treatment of lung cancer?
I think that's a great point. I think that clinical trials offer the chance to make treatments better for current patients and for future patients. And I would encourage patients to participate in clinical trials whenever possible. These are trials which have undergone very rigorous review and assessments both at the national level and at the local level by ethics committees. And they really are the only way that we're going to improve outcome for patients with lung cancer. I think if you ask your physician, are there clinical trials that are available? And if you ask questions about the risks and benefits of the individual trial, the doctors and research nurses will be very helpful with you in trying to understand why clinical trials are important. I want to remind patients, for the vast majority of clinical trials, there is no placebo group. There are unusual trials in the U.S. that actually involve placebo groups. And if you ask your doctor, they will honestly tell you if there's a placebo group or not. And nobody would ever put you on a clinical trial without telling you if a placebo was involved. So I think clinical trials are absolutely essential to improving outcome, not only for lung cancer, but for any of a number of solid tumors and leukemias.
And we have another question from one of our online participants, and the question really has to do with they're just feeling very frustrated and not really having the strength they had before, and just feeling just so really frustrated is the word that they're using. And I wonder if, Wynn, could you comment on that to start, and then we'll have other speakers as well.
Okay. I think in a way I'm going to go back to something I said a little bit earlier. And usually that frustration is based on the fact that we're trying to judge our standards of activity by standards that we had set before we were diagnosed with lung cancer. And I think the real helping coping strategy is to be able to say, hey, I'm in treatment with lung cancer, and I'm going to be less strong. But if I set new standards so that I'm not able to walk around the block right now, but I am able to walk over out to the mailbox and set new standards, and when we achieve those standards, feel good about what we've achieved. The other thing is that this isn't going to be forever. This is going to be through our treatment, but that when we come through our treatment, chances are we will be able to again change the standards to that new situation and environment. That's one of the ways that we work with folks here at CancerCare in dealing with that frustration.
Dr. Collins? This is Donna.
Oh, Donna. Okay.
This is Donna Wilson. I agree with that as well. I think the most important thing is don't think about, like, if you were able to do good walking, and but do it maybe slower. So you work on that consistently and your endurance level, but just that you're actually still moving. But again, I agree 100% that think of it, this is the present time and how you're doing it, and not look at it like, oh, I'm so frustrated comparing yourself from before.
Dr. Holland?
No, well, I think I would just second all of that, except that, you know, it is frustrating, and you're going to be frustrated, so finding some way to set that aside and move forward is clearly a way to go, because frustration is a part of what we experience when we find that we can't do exactly what we did before.
And Dr. Lynch?
Well, I mean, I think that it's important to weigh all these factors in making treatment decisions and to recognize that one thing doesn't work for one approach or one option doesn't work for all patients, and that you really have to work with your team to come up with an approach that works best for you.
And Dr. Gralla?
Well, I being last in line here is interesting in this. I think that Dr. Holland really touched on it very well, as the other speakers have. And of course, it is indeed frustrating, and we recognize that. It's a term I even used in my presentation, because so many patients have told me the same. But I think that the adjustments and the realization, mature realization, is helpful. And then if you want to do more, both Dr. Lynch and I have mentioned clinical trials that one might want to get into, which could address either the lung cancer or it could address the fatigue, the trials that I mentioned. And that might give a person the satisfaction that they're working in a direction to try to overcome the fatigue while at the same time adjusting to a new reality. And I think all of these are realistic. And the tips that were outlined before on dealing with the fatigue at work and other things like this, sort of living with it, dealing with it, but not letting it stop you from doing the things that are important, those strategies can be very helpful.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank all of our speakers. This has been an extraordinary call, I have to say. This has been an amazing call. I want to thank all of our speakers for their presentations. I want to thank all of you who either queued up by voice or by email and posed questions that allowed our speakers to then further elaborate on issues that were of concern to you. And I also want to thank all of you that are listening. And I do want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour education program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do want to remind you that we do have a staff at Cancer Care of 40 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we are here to provide a host of services, from practical and financial assistance to counseling services to support groups, and really to have someone that you can really just talk to about some of your concerns. You can call us at 1-800-813-HOPE or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Most importantly, we are approaching the holiday time of year, and this can be sometimes the time of year that has its own particular stresses, and I want you to all be reminded that you do have support available to you. I don't want anyone to leave the call today feeling that you are alone. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support from Cancer Care, as Wynn had said, that good neighbor, and that we are here to help you. And so I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I look forward to your being on other programs and to your feedback, and thank you all, and have a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect, and have a wonderful day.